This is tape number two on St. Augustine.
To Augustine, his conversion in Milan in A.D. 386 took place because God was helping him to arrive at the stage of spiritual understanding. But Augustine looks at understanding itself as a kind of halfway house between simple faith and a more ultimate arrival, the direct immediate vision of divine beauty itself. The writings of the Neoplatonist philosopher Plotinus repeatedly insist that the human soul is made for exactly that vision of divine beauty. But this implies a peculiar way of understanding human existence. His biographer Porphyry tells us how Plotinus felt about possessing a human body.
Plotinus seemed ashamed of being in the body. As a result of this state of mind, he could never bear to talk of his race, or his parents, or his native country.
Plotinus was convinced that there was something basically askew in the fact that our souls were encased in bodies. He thought we were originally fashioned for a purely spiritual life of unbroken contemplation. Hence, Porphyry tells us that even while in the body, Plotinus enjoyed constant contact with the divine.
Plotinus never, while awake, relaxed his intent concentration upon the divine. So to this godlike man above all, who often raised himself in thought to the first and transcendent God, that God appeared. For the end and object of his life was to be united to approach the God above all things. Four times while I was with him, he attained that term in an inexpressible actuality, not merely in potency.
Something very like Plotinus's view of human existence rubbed off on Augustine in A.D. 386. He thought that our souls were never meant to be clothed in these sluggish bodies. We originally dwelled in the other higher world that Plato told us about. Humans were once rapturously contemplating God's splendorous beauty. But we've somehow, mysteriously, fallen into this embodied existence, and our souls, in their utmost depths, ache to return to that higher world. Nothing else should be of any real importance to us. So in the record of Augustine's Cacciochiacum dialogues with himself, called soliloquies, Augustine asks himself,
"What do you wish to know?"
"I wish to know God and the soul."
"Nothing more?"
"Nothing whatever."
The ordinary world of the senses has ceased to interest this recent convert. In fact, Augustine feels positively obliged to flee that world. He wants to purify and strengthen his mind's eye for the higher, purely spiritual vision he's come to long for. This disdain of sense knowledge, which Augustine called mere curiosity, understandably retarded the advance of empirical science in later centuries. But Augustine was confident that his Christianity and his Platonism, welded together into seamless unity, required that impatient leap into the world of the spirit. So, too, Augustine calmly characterizes the vision he seeks in frankly erotic terms that are at once Platonic and Christian. Pursuing the inquiry of his soliloquies, the voice of reason explains to Augustine,
"What we are exploring at the moment is this. What kind of love you bear for wisdom?"
For Augustine, this voice of reason belongs to the same otherworldly divine wisdom described in Cicero's Hortensius. Now, as years before, divine wisdom takes on the characteristic of a beautiful woman.
"You long to see and clasp her, naked, chastely to behold and embrace her, stripped of every intervening veil. But she permits this only to a very few chosen lovers. Were you inflamed with love for a beautiful woman, she would be right not to yield herself to you if she discovered that you loved something beside herself. So with the most chaste beauty of wisdom. Will she show herself to you unless you burn with love for her alone?"
Here we've touched on the very nerve of Augustine's ethical theory. He believes our principal business in life is to arrive at the vision of God. The value of everything else must be measured as a help or hindrance in reaching that vision. In his later work, entitled On Christian Doctrine, Augustine puts it this way.
Since, therefore, our destiny is to find our joy in the vision of that truth who lives unchangeably, our minds need to be purified in order to become strong enough to glimpse that light and cling to it once glimpsed. Let us look on that process of purification as though it were something like a journey on foot, something like a sea voyage to our homeland. For it is not, of course, by spatial motions that we travel to him who is everywhere present, but by holy desire and good morals.
To Augustine, we're all on a journey, and we must never lose sight of where we're going. We're going home. That's where we want to stop at last, to stay and rest and journey no more. The inns along the way, however warm and comfortable, are only way stations on the road home. Using this metaphor of the journey towards God, Augustine says,
of all the good things, the only goods we are meant to enjoy are those which are eternal and unchangeable. All the others are meant to be used to help us arrive at the enjoyment of those eternal goods.
Clearly, however, there's only one such eternal and unchangeable good. That's God. It's God whom we hope to behold and embrace. Augustine says that this union produces bliss. Paul the Apostle described this bliss to the Christians at Corinth in these words.
No eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man conceived what God has prepared for those who love him.
At this point, we've also found the key to Augustine's mature attitude towards sex. Sexual delight is like a very special amenity furnished at an elegantly appointed inn. Perhaps no other human good can rival the bewitching power of sex to make us forget our final destination. Sex can make us mistake a stopover for that destination. But the blissful union of sex is the merest shadow of the union with God that's promised us if we persevere on the homeward journey. We must admit that there's something chilling when we divide good things into those to be used as against the one divine good to be enjoyed. We instinctively believe that we can legitimately use things like bread or wine or inns, but are we meant to use our mothers, siblings, friends, to use other people? Augustine was very sensitive to this difficulty, and he tried various ways of softening its sting. He eventually concludes, for example, that we may enjoy our dear ones, but we must enjoy them in God.
Any creature we love is either our equal or our inferior. So we must love creatures below us by using them to get to God, while loving those equal to us with a love of enjoyment, by enjoying them in God.
And yet enjoying other human beings in God comes down to loving them not for their own sake, but for the sake of arriving at the enjoyment of God. Other people are like the refreshment or stopping places that sustain us on our journey. In the final analysis, Augustine's oversimple distinction that we must either use or enjoy forces him to conclude that indeed, even other persons are meant to be used.
For when you enjoy another human in God, it is God you are enjoying, rather than the human being. But if you would become attached and make the one you love a kind of home, locating the end point of your joy in the beloved, then you can truly be said to enjoy him or her. And this you must never do, except with the Trinity, which is the loftiest and unchangeable good.
Augustine's teaching on love is yet one more example of his confidence that Platonic conceptions can clarify the gospel message. Indeed, during his early years as a Catholic thinker, Augustine boldly viewed Platonism as the providentially arranged way to understand the very same truths the Cattolica teaches people to accept on faith. Plato reasoned that there were two worlds, one visible, the other invisible. The visible world is a blend of reality and unreality, and only the invisible, intelligible world is genuinely real. Augustine assures us that this insight helps Plato's followers to accept the words of Christ himself, "My kingdom is not of this world." There had been a time when Augustine felt that the demands of human reason clashed with the requirements of the Catholic faith. That clash, he became convinced, is an illusory one. Now he can say confidently,
"No one doubts that we are drawn toward learning by the twin magnetic pull of authority and reason. I am utterly certain that I shall never diverge on any point from the authority of Christ, for I find no authority stronger than his. But as for what must be sought after through subtle reasoning, I am confident that for now I shall find among the Platonists a teaching that is not opposed to our holy mysteries. For my heart is now set on this. I have an impatient yearning, not only to believe, but also to lay hold of what is true by the power of understanding."
In the year 386, Augustine felt that all the rivers of his past had flowed together into one powerful channel. All his tensions and spiritual discords had settled into peaceful harmony. His Christian faith once had seemed to clash with his intelligence. Now faith provided him with a larger, more satisfying understanding than he'd ever dreamed possible. His passionate heart had run madly against his religious ideals. Now both his worldly ambitions and rebellious sexuality were pacified by the hope of more sublime joys than he'd ever known. Augustine could now turn from the strident contentions of his professional life. He could be still and know that God is God. Augustine entered the quiet garden of the contemplative life and closed the gate firmly behind him. We know that Augustine enjoyed a contented, even blissful state of soul for several idyllic months after his conversion at Milan. But there were problems hidden in the heart of the synthesis that had come from his meditations at Cassiacum. He would in time come to deal with most of them, but two are worth mentioning. In the first place, Augustine was convinced that the Christian, like any human being, must begin by believing certain things. But he was equally convinced that this stage of belief leads onward to a search for a philosophic understanding of revealed truths. Philosophical understanding, in turn, leads onward to the bliss of direct, unmediated vision. In fact, for some time after his conversion at Milan, Augustine cherished the hope that contemplative immersion in the liberal arts might prepare him to enjoy that vision, perhaps even like Plotinus, while still living in the body. But this type of Christianity is for the intellectual mystic. It's a religion requiring more than most believers could give. Augustine himself admits that such a Christian must have special qualities.
"He must be equipped by nature with a good mind, blessed with the leisure which either the privilege of old age or good fortune can procure, and burning with zeal for study."
It's little wonder, then, that the simpler faith of Augustine's own mother, Monica, may have made her the most challenging obstacle to her son's thinking. Augustine strains to persuade Monica that she should not feel hostile toward the program of studies he's urging on his companions. He even flatters his mother about her faith.
"Since you have already arrived at the very summit of philosophical wisdom, would I not happily enroll as your disciple?" On hearing those words, my mother replied, all sweetness and charity, that I had never before lied so grandly.
Some years later, Augustine would come to realize how much wisdom was contained in Monica's good-natured mockery. There's a second problem with Augustine's conviction. He'd made the Platonic doctrine of participation a central pillar of his synthesis. That doctrine taught that all the realities of the sensible world share in the qualities they possess because they receive their share of those qualities from the corresponding ideal realities of the higher world. Good things receive their goodness from the ideal goodness. Beautiful things receive their beauty from the ideal beauty, and so forth. But Augustine had not yet come to see that the very heart of the participation doctrine is the powerful, technical, but also very difficult insight of integral omnipresence. Let's look at this omnipresence insight negatively first. It forbids us to think of God the way the Manichees did, as an infinitely extended ocean of spiritual splendor spread out in space, up there and out there. The spiritual world is not just a lofty counterpart of the material reality we're familiar with, spread out down here. A spiritual reality, like God or like the human soul, is not spread out that way into length and breadth, height and depth. It would be a small improvement to reverse the relationship and imagine all of created reality as being in God. This, Augustine tells us, he came to do.
I placed before my mind's eye the entire universe of creatures, as though they were all bodily realities arranged in this and that place, as imagination would have it. I made your creation into one immense mass, but finite in every respect. And I imagined, Lord, that you surrounded it on every side and interfused with it, but you were infinite in every direction, as though there were a sea, one single sea, stretching everywhere and infinitely in every direction, a boundless immensity. And that sea enclosed within itself a kind of sponge, as great in size as you please, but still finite. And that sponge was filled, obviously, in every one of its parts, filled with the immense sea.
Even in this image, part of God would be present here and another part of him there. God would not be present in the totality of his being to each and every created reality. Plotinus masterfully describes how a correct concept of integral omnipresence requires us to set aside our ordinary schemes for understanding spatially extended realities. He warns us how not to think of the omnipresent.
It is not to be thought of as coextensive with the material universe, or with any part of that universe. It is utterly outside of the quantitative, hence it cannot be coextensive with anything. Extension is a bodily property. What is not a body but the opposing spiritual type of reality has no such extension. But where there is no extension, there is no spatial distinction, nothing of here-ness or there-ness. How then can a placeless being of this sort undergo division?
Instead of thinking about the omnipresent in bodily spatial images, Plotinus says we must strive to think of how souls are present to each other.
They are present, each to all, as never having been set in opposition. They are no more hedged off by boundaries than are the multiple items of knowledge in one mind.
To make his point, Plotinus is driven to employ a host of riddling expressions. The omnipresent is both nowhere and everywhere. It's present wherever its powers reach, but it's both present and yet at the same time separate, multiple and yet one. Obviously, Plotinus is dealing here with a terribly difficult idea. It's no wonder, then, that study of Augustine's early writings shows that it took him several years to gain command of this concept of integral omnipresence. His Catechiacum dialogues hint vaguely at it here and there, but Augustine shows no signs of being able to use it in any formal or sophisticated way. The relative absence in the Catechiacum dialogues of omnipresence thinking contrasts markedly with the startling way this notion penetrates the confessions. Even after leaving Manichaeism, for example, Augustine still entertained a concept of God as extended through space.
My soul fashioned a God for itself, which extended through every place in the infinity of space, and it believed that this was you.
Now, some years later, Augustine describes the new view of divine reality that transcends all such sensist imagery. This view of divine reality, he claims, is authentically intellectual.
But you caressed my head and closed my eyes, and I awoke, to see that you are infinite, but in a different fashion. And that way of seeing was not derived from a fleshly source. I saw that all finite realities are in you, but not as though you were a place. They were in you in a different fashion, because you uphold all things by your truth hand.
By God's truth hand, Augustine means the purely spiritual truth represented in the Christian faith as the eternal Son of the Father. Augustine deliberately employs a grammatically daring hyphenation, truth hand, to dramatize how the idea of integral omnipresence stunningly defies all sensist ways of thinking about God. The Confessions stress omnipresence thinking very strongly. But in the earlier Kasekiyakum dialogues, this insight is relatively absent. This contrast suggests that after 10 years, Augustine felt free to bring a number of insights into play which had not fully ripened as early as that spring and summer of the year 386. By carefully studying Augustine's writings from the first few years after the Kasekiyakum dialogues, we can see that those writings issued from a stubborn process of reading, reflection, and occasional self-correction. That way, Augustine first reached a tentative, then later a more confident synthesis. In short, Augustine had to work steadily over a number of years before he could produce the comprehensive worldview he presents in Book 7 of his Confessions. He worked in this worldview first in Italy, then after he returned to Africa in the year 388, but he continued to work on it at least up until the year 395, and probably till 397 or 398. But we've already glimpsed another fleeting indication of Augustine's developing worldview. We noticed earlier that when Augustine referred to the statement, "I am who am," from the book of Exodus, he interpreted it as meaning that divine truth exists in a way that utterly transcends all created realities. Does Augustine imply by this that everything else besides God exists in some lesser, attenuated fashion? Puzzling though that may sound, Augustine's very next paragraph in the Confessions tells us we've understood him correctly.
"And I examined those other realities inferior to you, and I saw that they do not altogether exist, nor do they altogether not exist. For they do exist, since they derive their existence from you, and yet they do not altogether exist, since they are not what you are. For that alone truly exists, which endures without any change."
Anything that changes, therefore, even anything that's capable of changing, cannot be said to exist in the fullest sense of that term. Augustine here applies the Neoplatonic insight that there are ascending grades of goodness and beauty. But Augustine's also reminding us of an assumption that's fundamental to that insight. If we apply these grades of goodness and beauty to human beings and other beings, we must then acknowledge that beings are more or less real. They approximate more or less truly the perfect pattern of an ideal being. If we grade anything on its goodness, beauty, or authenticity, we have necessarily graded it on the quality of its reality. This does not mean that the Platonist is uninterested in answering simple yes or no questions, such as, "Is this a human being?" The Platonist knows, as does the Aristotelian, that such questions can be answered by exploring whether or not the definition of human being correctly applies to the specimen under examination. But the Platonist is perhaps even more interested in a different range of questions. He's particularly interested in evaluative questions like, "How good a person is this?" Or, "How true is it to say that this man is a genuinely human being?" Like any Platonist, Augustine would recognize grades of perfection among the members of any single class of beings. For example, some humans are more human and some horses are horsier than others. Augustine would also say that different classes of beings can be similarly graded, one class relative to the others. He sees, for example, that stones, cabbages, antelopes, and humans are all beings, in the sense that they all exist. But Augustine adds the qualification that each of these different types of being exists in either lower or higher degrees. Their very reality is qualitatively inferior or superior in kind. Augustine's evaluative style of thinking will soon furnish him with a kind of qualitative ladder. With it, he will ascend mentally from the realities of human experience to the divine reality beyond the reach of direct human contact.
I began to ask why I found myself positively evaluating the beauty of bodily realities, and what empowered me to judge aright, as when I said things about changeable realities like, "This being here is as it should be, but not so that one over there." Probing, then, into why I made such judgments, for make them I did, I saw that I had come to discover the unchangeable and true eternity of truth, which exists above my changeable mind.
We all make such judgments, Augustine reminds us. We all rank certain realities as relatively inferior or superior to others in their class. We also sometimes rank one entire class of realities relative to another class. But we can make no such relative rankings unless we implicitly refer to some absolute standard of evaluation. As Plato frequently argued, we can't say this is more beautiful than that, unless we have some notion of what we mean by absolute and perfect beauty. Then, once we're secure in that realization, we can pursue that upward ascent which Augustine describes.
Thus I passed gradually upward from bodies to soul, and thence to the soul's highest reasoning power. When this, my reasoning power, proved to be a changeable reality, it stretched itself upward to its power of understanding, in order to discover what light it was that flooded into it, whenever it proclaimed, beyond all doubting, that the unchangeable must be ranked superior to the changeable, and by the same token to discover whence it gained that knowledge of the unchangeable. For it must possess that knowledge in some fashion, else it could never so unhesitatingly have ranked the unchangeable over the changeable. Thus, in a flash of trembling sight, it came to glimpse that which exists, God.
This ascending process is sometimes referred to as the Augustinian proof for the existence of God. Looked at more closely, though, Augustine's saying that none of us really needs a proof for God's existence. In the moment we make any judgment of relative value, Augustine claims that we implicitly acknowledge an absolute standard of value. This absolute, Augustine would assure us, is God. We have seen that Augustine's mature concept of God as a spaceless, timeless reality reached its full development some years after he wrote the Cassiacum dialogues. There's scarcely a trace in the dialogues of his insight that there are grades of being. He's glimpsed that certain things are superior to others in their goodness or their beauty, but he's not yet gotten the insight that these grades of goodness and beauty mean that the beings in question are also more or less real, more or less truly existent. Augustine began experimenting with this notion only when writing the little work On the Immortality of the Soul, some time after his return from Cassiacum to Milan. Even later, Augustine begins deliberately to apply the precise method of ascending the grades of being. Hence, while this central section of the Confessions might initially appear to describe Augustine's first acquaintance with Neoplatonic writings, it's in fact something quite different. It's a highly condensed summary of the later worldview to which Augustine came only gradually. He'd caught glimmers of it at Milan, had begun to elaborate it in the Cassiacum dialogues, then worked at it perseveringly during the years which followed. This finding's a comforting one. It assures us that understanding this section of the Confessions is tantamount to understanding Augustine's mature worldview. One additional feature of Augustine's grades of being concept deserves attention. Augustine describes the unchangeable light that he's glimpsed, and he says that it revealed to him truth, eternity, and love.
Whoever knows the truth knows that light, and whoever knows that light knows eternity. Love knows it, O eternal truth, and true love, and beloved eternity, you are my God, and I sigh for you, day and night.
Here Augustine's clearly alluding to the Christian Trinity. Truth is identified with the Divine Son, love with the Holy Spirit, and eternity, mentioned three distinct times, seems to characterize both the person of the Father and also the nature of the Godhead. We can compare that with Augustine's further comment that creatures both are and are not.
For that which truly exists remains unchangeable, but the good for me consists in cleaving fast to my God. For if I do not remain in him, I shall not be able to remain in myself. But he, remaining in himself, renews all things.
Augustine's told us that only God truly exists, only God, in the fullest sense of the term. But observe how strongly he hammers home the precise reason why that's so. The mark of perfect and plenary existence is, to his mind, unchangeableness, or eternity. That which truly exists, he writes, remains or endures unchangeably. Augustine uses a Latin term that we translate as endure or remain. That term, manere, implies two things. First, that God remains in the sense that he continues to exist. Second, the term further implies that God unchangeably remains exactly what he is. God suffers no alteration whatever in the incomparably perfect way he exists. Eternity, or immutability, is the first property that occurs to Augustine when characterizing the nature of God. By the same token, the first adjective he uses to characterize all other realities is mutable, changeable, or temporal. This constitutes the radical difference between God and creatures. A difference which appears so radical, in fact, that some thinkers have wondered whether there could be any positive relationship between an utterly unchangeable God and a constantly changing world. And yet, Augustine insists, God could not renew all things, could not be creator of the ever-changing world, unless he remained utterly in himself.
I saw that you, who alone are eternal, did not begin to work after innumerable tracks of time, because all tracks of time and everything that has passed and will pass away would neither go out of being nor come into being unless you remained and remained at work.
The book of Genesis tells us that God rested on the seventh day of creation. The ordinary reader might be tempted to infer from that that God still remains immutably at rest. But in that case, what would become of Christ's saying that the Father works until now and I work too? Augustine takes the dilemma by both horns. God's remainingness or abidingness is precisely the changelessness of a God unremittingly engaged in renewing all things in the changing world. Creatures, on the other hand, cannot, by their very nature, remain exactly what they are and the way they are from one moment to the next. Indeed, to exist in time, they must move inexorably from moment to moment in an unending series of losses and gains, dyings and renewals.
Whatever can change is not, once changed, what it was. And if it is not what it was, a certain death has taken place in it. Something that was there has been taken away and is not any more. The darkness of his hair has died on the head of the graying elder. Dead is the strength of the body, which now is ill.
Temporal life, in one of Augustine's unforgettable coinages, is a living death, a dying life. So he depicts his own life. To live as a child, he must die to his infancy. To live as an adolescent, he must die to his boyhood. And so on to that final divestment, when we die to old age and step into the life after death. In his famous meditation on eternity and time, in the 11th book of the Confessions, Augustine shows that the same thing is true of our every passing moment. Our life is like a line of poetry. The first syllable, even the first portion of the first syllable, must necessarily die away in order for the second mini-portion to begin its own fleeting existence. But what does this kind of thinking do to the present moments of our existence? In his Confessions, Augustine toys with the notion that the present moment might have no duration at all. But some years later, he came to see that, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as a durationless instant.
I look for a present moment, but nothing stands still. What I have spoken no longer exists. What I am about to say does not yet exist. Talk about changing things, and all you can find is was and will be. But talk about God, and you will find only is.
Let's apply Augustine's own example of the syllable. Think of how you pronounce the very word, time. The T must stop sounding to let the I begin to sound, and so on for the M and the E, which doesn't sound at all. But trying to locate the precise moment when the T stops sounding and the I begins is as contradictory as inserting a gap of silence into an unbroken flow of sound. If we try to imagine the present as an indivisible instant that's neither past nor future, we soon realize that such an instant could have no thickness, no duration, whatever. It would be an instant out of time, not a moment of and in time. Even the word instant, which comes from the Latin word for stand, is deceptive. It caters to the illusion that we might discover some moment of time which actually stands still. But the frightening truth about our temporal existence is that we never do stand still. We are radically and irremediably unstable. We're like someone swept along by a river in flood. Our feet flail about trying to touch bottom so we can take a stand. But the bottom's beyond our reach. Indeed, the terrifying thought is that there may be no bottom at all. Heraclitus, centuries before, had pointed to the same experience.
You could not step twice into the same rivers, for other and yet other waters are flowing on. Other things enter the same rivers, and other waters pour in upon them.
Augustine comes very close to outdoing Heraclitus. If we carry Augustine's thought to its logical conclusion, we may say that you can't step into the same river even once. So Augustine brilliantly conveys a sense of insecurity, of vertigo, of stomach-wrenching panic. That seizure of angst, to borrow a modern word, is very much part of Augustine's feeling for time and temporal existence. That may go far to explain why he insists so strongly on what eternity really means.
God's years are not something other than God himself. God's years are his eternity, and eternity is God's very substantial reality, in which there is nothing changeable. Nothing is past there as though it no longer existed. Nothing there is future, as though not yet existing. There is nothing in him but is.
Eternity, for Augustine, is not simply a kind of everlastingness. It's not an infinite length of time, having neither beginning nor end. This would put God into time and change. It would accord him the kind of existence that shot through, like our own, with non-existence. It would make God as radically unstable and metaphysically insecure as we are. But Augustine's convinced that God truly deserves the Jewish name used in the Old Testament, the Rock. For God alone stands. He alone is stable, solid, utterly secure. So for Augustine, the natural partner to God's immutability is his unchanging eternity.
This is the end of Side One. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.